Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to some of the people who sold their goods at Fair November this past weekend. It was the 45th edition of Fair November, the annual craft show at the University of Guelph that takes place over two floors and 4 days at the University Center with a wide variety of hats, jewelry, pottery, edibles, and other homemade goods. It's a big date on the local craft fair calendar, and it's an important yearly destination for people looking for that one-of-a-kind holiday gift. And though some students may find it tough to navigate to and from the cafe, this is a tradition at the U of G that is nearly half a century old. Fair November is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, Fair November is huge, there's no doubt about it. It has 85 designers and artisans that take part every year, and it's always the packed house. The fair has long hours, a 4-day schedule, an easy-to-access location, which is all big selling points for Fair November, and there's also the fact that there's no admission fees, and then lots of coffee and food nearby for when you want to take a break. And then there are those helpful student volunteers who are there to marshal the visitors and assist the vendors as needed. It's a veritable utopia for people who enjoy handmade crafts and artisans, in other words. And make no mistake either, the craft business is booming. The Association for Creative Industries noted that there was a 45% increase in revenue from the handcraft business between 2011 and 2017. That is a $30.1 billion difference, according to Merits CX, which is a firm that specializes in consumer-based research. That's big when you consider that $30 billion is half of what the entire professional sports industry makes in the United States in a given year. In other words, homemade arts and crafts are big business, but we don't really talk about them like they are. According to Etsy, which is the largest online platform for the sellers of homemade goods, 87% of their sellers are women, 50% of them live in suburban areas, and 90% of them own their own business. And if they work with a partner, then chances are that that partner is a family member. And it's not just a passion to create either, because half of the people on Etsy got into business to be in business, and almost a third of them consider their homemade business their primary occupation. So it is serious. But there's also a lot of love. At least there is for the artisans at Fair November. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, I talked to W. Bruce Smith of Paddles, Sarah Allison Schorbrick of Ontario Honey Creations, Karen Wilson of Karen Wilson Handbags, Stefan Marinov of Kokobora Creations, Wanda Lane of Stonescapes, Nancy Smith of Under the Divvy, Errol Caldwell of Turning Point, and Charlene Downey of Noggins. With these vendors, we discuss the fine points of their arts and crafts, how they turn their hobbies into thriving businesses, and what makes Fair November such an important destination for craft makers and craft enthusiasts alike. So I caught up with a few of these 85 vendors at Fair November this past Sunday at the University Center.
Cool.
So there'd be a little more familiarity then.
Yeah. But I kind of... She said, do you remember the paddle my dad made for me? Or you made for my dad to give me as my 16th birthday paddle? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, I've been the director at Taylor Statton Camps in Algonquin Park for years. I have about 9 paddles at home, she said, and that's still my favorite paddle.
Wow.
So that was made in 1970.
Says a lot about your quality, but I mean, not a lot of repeat business if people are still using your old paddles.
It's funny when people are walking through here, though, I love my paddle, I love it, because they bought it several years ago, and then... Yeah, but actually they do come back for more, and they buy for their spouses and their children and their fellow employees that are retiring at work and stuff like that. So repeat sales is my number one source of new sales.
Okay. You said you were a teacher in your pre-career, your pre-paddling career. What kind of teacher were you?
I started out... with a desire to teach outdoor education. I had graduated in geology and earth science, and I just always had a fascinating with the outdoors and stuff. So And by the time I got there, they had cut the funding to outdoor education. So had to go through a few years of teaching secondary and elementary. It was about 5 years all total. Then I was able to get a job at a place called Portage in Allure. It's a, a rehab program for young offenders and kids in trouble. So I taught. I created my own job.
Which are usually the best ones.
I ended up teaching... I started teaching science and math there, but I ended up teaching construction technology and outdoor education, which is a perfect fit for me.
Yeah.
I had all the certification for all that kind of stuff. And so we ended up making there, making canoes and paddles and taking kids on seven-day canoe trips to Tamagami and so on. And so I did that for most of the 23 years that I was there. It was pretty interesting. So I kind of stayed in the whole field of outdoor education and canoeing and stuff. Ever since I went in to Camp Summerland at the Early YMCA camp in 1960.
Wow. So how long does it take 61. You to... 61. All right, good correction. how long does it take you to get a paddle, like from just the unshaped piece of wood to when it's... in somebody's hand? How long does that take?
Yeah, I get that question quite a bit. It takes me about 5 hours, including the time to recode it. You get faster. I cut it on the bandsaw the best I can, and then I shave it down with a spoke shave. It's all by hand, too. So when I say my paddles are handmade, they're totally handmade.
Right.
They're hand-eye coordination. My paddles aren't on a machine at any stage. Mm-hmm. Being spun by a machine and then sanded by hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is that difference when you say handmade and when you see other paddles like at sale or the sporting goods store and they say handmade? You know, what's the difference?
Those paddles almost entirely are made on a CNC machine.
Mm.
Some are made on a CNC is a computerized router that makes it in minutes essentially. Mm. And then they often clip it off with a bandsaw by hand and then sand it on a big drum sander by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so they call it a handmade paddle. But really, the truly handmade paddle is not made that way, but truly by hand. Another machine they use is called a copy lathe, and it's like a key cutter at a hardware store. And those two types of paddles are often too thick when they're done. Because they when you do it by hand, you can carve them thinner and get them just to the right thickness, right?
And real paddlers, if there is such a thing, know the difference.
Absolutely. The more you paddle, the more you realize the difference. And that doesn't mean you can't find a good machine-made paddle. You just have to look through the rack to find the right one that's got the right amount of flex.
Right.
There's just not as many. Whereas when you get a handmade paddler, whether it's me, whether it was Albert Ma in 1920 in Algonquin Park, or whether it was... or any of the other guys that truly make them totally by hand, 80-90% of their paddles are all premier, not just the odd one.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, so.
Well, if people want to check out your paddles, Bruce, where can they find you online?
Bruce Smith. If you just punch in Bruce Smith paddles, I pop right up my website. I'm right there.
So your business, your passion is honey?
Yes, absolutely.
So how did you get into the honey business?
Yeah, we were actually hobbyists. My husband and I started this by accident with two hives about 7 years ago. And then slowly snowballed. Now we've left my corporate job. We're doing this both full-time and absolutely loving it. We manage about 500 colonies right now.
I should say the name Ontario Honey Creations.
Yes.
And just from walking around observing the place, this is a pretty popular corner. People are interested in honey and honey products.
Absolutely, yeah. There's so many benefits to honey. You can get allergy relief. That's just part of my passion. So you can offer different seasonal honeys and various healing properties that come naturally with a true, raw, unpasteurized honey product. Mm-hmm.
You said you left a corporate job. Can I ask what you used to do?
Yeah, I used to be in HR management.
Oh, wow.
Now I just deal with bee stings instead of people. So there you go.
Question of which one's more annoying.
True. We won't answer that one.
Okay. Yeah. So 500 hives. Yeah. I mean, so what does your day look like in terms of, you know, managing 500 hives whilst getting the honey, making the products? You know, what does a day in the life of you look like?
It's constantly changing. That's one thing. It's never dull. The bees themselves, you check in on every 7 to 10 days throughout the season. And then there's a lot of behind the scenes that goes on. So the market prep, the bottling, the labeling of the products themselves, creating the various product lines, so the cream tunnies and honey vinegars, it's constantly on the go. And then managing your day-to-day life and family on top of all that. Not much sleep.
So is this year-round that you're always making, managing the bees?
Very good question. So the bees themselves this time of year have kind of hunkered down, so we get them ready for the winter. Okay. And then we do winter prep, which is essentially wrapping the hives, and then they take care of themselves if given the proper conditions. So enough honey in there, and they'll eat the honey stores throughout the winter time. From the business end of it, it is all year round, so I'm constantly doing different events, wholesale and farmers markets.
Where are you based?
Yeah, we're based just north of Orangeville in a little town called Amaranth.
Okay.
And then the hives themselves are all throughout the GTA. So Headwaters region, Rouge Valley near the zoo, and in the city of Toronto as well.
So it's not all in your backyard.
No, absolutely not. They are all spread out. I only have about 24 hives on the farm there, and there's 44 acres. So they all go on private properties.
I ask where you're from and where you're based because you may know Guelph is a bee city.
Yes.
You've been authenticated a bee city. So I'm wondering if the honey business is better here than perhaps in other places you take your honey.
Yeah, it's actually great here. There's a huge appreciation for it on the university campus here today. This weekend, actually, it's been phenomenal. And it's nice to see that.
Have you been to been to Fair November before?
I have not. I'm a newbie.
Oh,
yes.
You're a newbie. Well done. So this is something you would do again? This is something that, you know, you can make this a regular appointment when you're traveling around with your honey?
Absolutely. I hope to be here again next year. Yeah.
I assume you are Karen Wilson?
I am Karen Wilson.
Okay, so I have your name.
It's a good start.
So you design handbags.
Design and make handbags, yes.
And what makes a Karen Wilson handbag?
Well, what makes a Karen Wilson handbag is they're all handmade. We're known for our Kisslock frame, the clasp on the top.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the sound that gets people.
Okay, let's see if we can capture the sound.
Capture the sound.
Yeah, oh yeah. You know it's shut.
It sounds like grandma closing up her purse.
Yeah.
So they're all handmade with new upholstery fabrics, leather trims. We put little feet on the bottom, and we can customize them by putting different fabrics on different shapes.
Okay. There is something old-fashioned-y about
yes.
them. Is that your inspiration? Are we trying to recapture?
Yeah, they're vintage-inspired. Mm-hmm. We do have some vintage fabrics, like this one's made with a vintage needlepoint. We repurpose some furs. But for the most part, they are new upholstery fabrics that inspire or represent that vintage time back in the 50s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How did you get into the handbag business?
I
should say handbag art, because this feels like a passion more than
that. Yes. I was making my, I was buying expensive handbags and thinking, you know, I could do this myself. I can sew. So I started making a few, and then people approached me about making them for them. And the next thing you know, I was in business. I found a couple of people who could sew, and we're basically home sewers.
Okay, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So is this your first time at Fair November?
This is my second time at Fair November.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
And how does this experience stack up with the other places you take your bags? How's the Guelph experience?
Oh, it's very good. I live in Rockwood now.
Oh, wow.
So I'm just 15 minutes away, and it's a nice local market for me to come to. I typically do larger shows like the one-of-a-kind show. I just came from a show in Vancouver that was 8 days long, 5 days long. So this is a nice respite from the large 800 vendor type show. It feels like a nice cozy atmosphere.
From a business perspective, how much of your business comes from just, you know, being out and about at shows like this?
I would say maybe a third of my business comes from shows. I do wholesale also, and then I have an online shop.
How many days a year are you on the road?
Certain times of the year, more than others. This is the make hay season.
Oh, yeah.
So from beginning of November to beginning of December, or midweek of middle of December, we're basically all on a caravan. We're roadies.
Roadies, I like that.
Yeah. It's not pretty sometimes.
Fair enough. If people want to check out your stuff online, where can they find it?
KarenWilson.ca.
I'm Stefan Marinov.
And you are in the business of selling creative-looking pens.
Yes, that's what made me famous. Originally, I started as a furniture maker, and then with the offcuts, I was making pens, and they took more interest than the actual furniture. So I switched to pens. And it's a lot easier to take a pen home than actually carry a big box with a furniture inside it.
Very true, very true. But, I mean, there's also the... not that furniture isn't practical, but, you know, pens... you use a pen every day, maybe you know it's something you think about as opposed to maybe something like a couch where you just sit on it and you sort of don't really think about it too much.
Speaking of which, you may need a new pen too.
good sales. So there's the practical you're talking about, you know, it's easier to take home a pen than take home furniture, but I don't want to phrase this the wrong way, but was that an indictment on your furniture making that people were more interested in your pens?
Not really. I mean, I know furniture is hard to sell. I mean, we have so many furniture stores; they all have sales, you know, $1 million inventory sales. So every person, every business that sells furniture is always going to have a harder time because you know you buy it once and you keep it for 5 or 6 years.
Mm.
But then a pen, you can have all kinds of variations, different colors. Different woods from all over the world, so it's different each and every time.
Can you talk a bit about like how some of these pens come together, like a little bit about your process? Don't feel like you have to give away any secrets, but I mean, just how does one make a pen?
I'm sure everybody can Google pen turning on and go to YouTube and find out how, but the basic idea is there are small brass tubes that hold the pen together, hold all the metal pieces of the pen together, and then I drill the wood and put on the brass tubes, and then I go to my lathe and basically turn it.
Mm-hmm. So what sets your pens apart? What makes a Stefan pen a unique piece?
I use woods from all over the world. I don't travel as much, unfortunately, but I go to the wood store and they deal with all the paperwork of import and export of wood. So I take those woods in their natural state, natural form, natural color, and I do them. I also use materials that you wouldn't think of using. I usually have a riddle here in my booth to make people guess what some things are made from.
Mm.
So I know the podcast is not going to show exactly, so I would say it out loud. Yes, I use pine cones or spruce cones for my products. And I use them with a different colored resins as well, so that kind of brings out the different aspects of the pen. And I can show you, and you can basically comment. So those are my pine cone pens right here. I have the red, green, brown, black, clear, and blue, although the blue is a bit dark.
It's a dark blue, but I can see the blue.
Yeah, so you can see it's all different and the same, you know, regular pine cone. And each one is every different because of... Somehow the blade, when it cuts the pine cone, it's either closer to the center or a little bit further away from the center, and that makes a difference in terms of how it looks at the end.
Right, and for people who can't see, you can see sort of the texture of the pine cone, but it's not prickly like a pine cone, but it certainly captures that feeling that this came from a pine cone.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting. Can I ask, do you still like maybe make furniture for your own sort of... Or is it all pens all the time for you?
I've done furniture. You can also see at my other side of the booth, I do have what I call light tables.
Yeah.
The inspiration for those came from my tabletop lamp that I have, which has about 16-inch diameter lampshade. And every time I accidentally hit the lampshade, then the lamp begins to wobble, and I wonder when it's going to end up on the floor. So I decided to basically put the light on the floor and have a whole wide space to put anything on top of it. So
you're solving problems.
Pretty much, yeah. So those are all my furniture that I have right now. I also have my shop cabinet. Mm-hmm. I know you can see it. No, people cannot see it, but that's my shop cabinet that I've done, I think, in about 2008 or 2009.
Oh, wow.
So it has been used as a shop cabinet. It has been used at show. It has been banged up, but it still holds together pretty nicely.
It looks solid. It looks solid.
Yeah, it's definitely solid. You can still dance on top of it.
Will there be a demonstration of that later?
probably not. I don't want to scare the customers away.
Fair enough.
But if somebody who knows how to dance wants to try it out, they're more than welcome to.
Have you been to Fair November before?
That's my third year.
Your third year?
Yes.
Is there something about this show, about the clientele you see here? What is it about Fair November?
It's about the experience most more than the customers. I do like, I mean, obviously everybody, every vendor likes customers.
Right.
But it's all about interacting with the people, telling them about what I do. And it's a show right before the busy Christmas season, so people are a little bit more relaxed. It's not as frigid cold as December months could be. And it's just nice atmosphere.
You can't tell in the basement here, but it is a nice day outside.
I drove in the sun, so I'm hoping it's still sunny out.
It is, it is. So you're Stonescapes, and can you describe... I don't want to sound like I'm talking out of school. I'm not an expert on the arts, but can you explain your work and what we're looking at here?
Okay. So I collect stones and shells and pieces of driftwood on the beach, and then I put them together to tell a story. Mm-hmm. I have a man make barn board frames for me. I actually buy the wood at Home Depot, stain it myself, and then he makes the frames. Mm-hmm. I cut a lot of my own glass, and I cut my own mats.
Oh, wow.
So they're pretty much made out of recycled material.
Okay.
And if you look at the pictures, they tell a story. There's a story about life.
Okay, well, let's pick one at random. I'll choose this one here of what looks like a child with balloons standing on a shore, and it's called Celebration. What's that story?
Well, my daughter-in-law actually did that picture, mm-hmm. and it simply represents joy. So it could be a personal celebration, or it could be an event. Celebrating a birthday, celebrating a family member.
Okay. I have a picture at home of my niece with balloons, so it kind of reminds me of that. This one here, love birds and laundry. I definitely get the laundry feeling.
Well, if you look in the middle of the clothesline, yes. there are two lovebirds.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised on a farm down on the Niagara Peninsula. And we had a clothesline, and I used to love hanging the clothes on the line and smelling the fresh clothes when you brought them in. So to me, that picture has very special meaning.
Mm-hmm. It's very nostalgic.
It is, very much so.
How does one get into this practice? Like, where did the initial inspiration to turn rocks and wood into this art come from?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I thought of it all by myself. But I didn't. Back in 2003, I went down to the East Coast with a couple of girlfriends. We had all retired as principals.
Oh, wow.
And one of the girls had a cottage, and we went down there for about a week, and we went around to a number of different shops in a little town, I think it was called New Glasgow, and we saw a young woman doing this type of art then.
So... principals usually come up from being teachers. Were you an art teacher?
No, I wasn't an art teacher. But I've always enjoyed doing creative things. So sewing, attempting to paint, quilting, things like that. So, but no, unfortunately, I never got to be an art teacher. I would have loved that, though.
I think you would have been good at it. Is this your first time at Fair November, or are you a frequent flyer?
No, second time. And hopefully I'll be back again next year.
Okay. I imagine you take your work to other fairs. Is there something about Fair November that is distinctive that puts us a cut above the other art fairs?
Well, it's very well organized. The crowd is amazing, and it's relatively close to home, which is appealing to me.
If people want to check out your work, do you have a website or any way they can find you online?
I have a Facebook page, Stonescapes by Wanda Lane.
And your crafts here are under the divvy. Have I said that right?
You have indeed, under the divvy.
So what is it? It's soap, right? So, but talk a little bit about your soap.
Sure. So basically, the products I offer are bath and body products. As an individual myself who has struggled with sensitive skin my entire life, you know, you have over the years come to find that there is a need for products that are helpful for sensitive skin.
Mm-hmm.
My first encounter with soap making was to learn how to make a charcoal soap for my face.
Okay.
I did a lot of research. I read, research. Finally, I had the nerve to try and make my first batch.
And once I made my first batch, I was hooked. It was a success. Loved it. And ever since then, I've just started making more and more. And then you realize, wow, I have a lot of soap. what am I going to do with it now? I can only use so many soaps. So here I am today.
How long did it take you to go from all the research you were doing to finally taking the plunge? How big was that ratio?
I'm going to say maybe about 9 months or so.
Wow.
Yes. The soap I make is called, I'm using the cold process method of soap making. So that's where you're taking sodium hydroxide, which is lye. You're mixing it with natural oils. So that's going to be your olive oil, coconut oil, shea butter, avocado oil, that type of thing. Lye being a caustic substance initially on its own, you know, it's very nerve-wracking, right? It's very intimidating to even undertake working with such a thing. But once I got over that initial fear and, you know, you're all safetied up with your goggles and gear, protective equipment, and you realize it's all doable and it's all good, and the end result is fabulous, so...
So you said you began with like a charcoal.
Yes.
So at what stage did you decide to branch out into various other mediums in the soap art?
All right. So my first batch of charcoal, that yielded me about 15 bars of soap. And for my own personal use, that's going to last a super long time. So I immediately began thinking, well, what else can I do? The next soap that I chose to make was scented with a raspberry lemonade fragrance. Just summer, fresh, fun. I made that. The oils I used were a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Super silky lather. That was my second experiment. Love that as well. And then again, you got to see how different the soap could be, depending on how you change up the ingredients. Yeah.
You're like your first like kind of customer. You have to make sure it's up to your standards first, it sounds like. And you're also, I guess, maybe the victim of some of your missteps along the way, too, that maybe there are some soaps that don't work out.
Well, and it's funny because occasionally people will ask me, do I test on animals? And the reality is I test on humans, being myself. I am my guinea pig.
Yeah. Into human testing. That's a good pull quote. You talked a bit about how it's hard for people with sensitive skin, and I imagine, you know, you go to the grocery store, you go to the pharmacy, you buy the bar soap there, the body lotion there, and you know, it's all mass produced, it's all comes from a factory, who knows where. How many people out there, and maybe you don't know, like the number according to the census or anything like that, but I mean, how much of your business is people who are faced with that affliction? Like, I can't go to the grocery store and buy soap because, you know, I just physically can't do it.
Absolutely, a very large portion. And it's funny, there's a lot of people out there that maybe don't realize the difference between store-bought soap and natural soap. Mm. And the first thing I want to touch on before we get into that is, you know, myself, having the sensitive skin, I spent the greater part of my... life using, and I don't know if I should say it, but Dove for sensitive skin, right? It was the best thing that I could find. The best thing that I could find that was for me at the time. And then once I began to research soap making, I actually began to realize that what I thought was soap is actually not soap. If you look on a box, it's a beauty bar. And a lot of the soaps that you're buying in the department stores, all the good ingredients have been taken out for more expensive products, and they're actually a detergent bar.
Right.
So that's the first big difference between store-bought and natural. Then, of course, you have, you know, again, the people who maybe now have an awareness that there is, you know, I have sensitivities. I'm going to start looking for things that are more natural. But at the same time, everybody's sensitivities are unique. Again, just because it's natural doesn't mean you're not going to react to it. I've had people even here this weekend who have a reaction to lavender. Lavender's a natural product by all means, right? But everybody's sensitivities are unique,
right.
And you always have to kind of, and unfortunately with skin, you learn the hard way. You use something,
right.
You have a reaction, you find, oh my gosh, I'm reacting to this. But we do our best to make it as natural as we can, and we choose products that hopefully, you know, are suitable for everybody, that everybody can use and enjoy. But whenever you do have sensitivities or allergies specifically, you have to just always be mindful and ask the vendors, you know, what is this made of? I'm allergic to such and such, you know, are any of those in your products?
Okay, good tip. If people are interested in your soaps, how can they find you online?
So my website is www.underthedivvy.com. From there, I have an events tab where you can see where I'm going to be located as well. You can order online, and I do offer free shipping on orders over $75.
Ooh, good promotion. You are the man who makes the products here for Turning Points. So a lot of wood, am I right in that?
Yes, yes. Lots of wood and a little bit of epoxy resin as well.
Okay. Where does the name Turning Point come from?
I just thought it was clever. I live on Pumpkin Point Road, and I do wood turning.
Okay.
So the Turning Point came to be.
Interesting, because it sounds like something like very like financial, like banking. We're Turning Point GPS investing. You're looking at me funny, so I'll move on to another question. So, what kind of products do you make?
I do wood turned bowls and plates and platters and candle holders and epoxy pieces as well, and other stuff in between.
Cutting boards, I see.
Cutting boards as well, cheese boards, charcuterie boards, yes.
And you have some boxes? It says puzzle or engagement boxes, so you make puzzle boxes.
That's correct. Those are boxes that are puzzle boxes. You take them apart, and if you can figure out how to take them apart, there's a little drawer inside.
Oh, is there a prize inside?
No, there's no prize, unless somebody's proposing to somebody else, and then there might be a little prize.
Interesting. Inside. So there's possibilities.
That's why they're called engagement boxes, too.
Ah, I see. Okay. So how did you get into woodworking? How did this come about?
My dad always worked in wood. I did a little bit of woodworking in high school and shop. And puttered around with it throughout my life and settled on wood turning primarily as my passion. So I've been doing this for 30 plus years and doing various shows as well.
30 plus years, wow. And how many years have you done Fair November?
I've been here, I believe, 9 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, over the last 10 years.
Okay. So is this a good show for you? Do you get a lot of people turning out to see your stuff and do good business here?
Yeah, it's a fabulous show actually, and this year's been especially good. I'm a graduate student from University of Guelph as well,
yes.
So it's kind of an opportunity to come back to my alma mater, and there's still a few people here, not very many, but still a few that I know from my student days.
You are recognized. I know the answer, but has the campus changed that much?
It has changed in some respects, but in other respects, it's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great sized campus. It's very comfortable, easy to get around, and it's got some great courses.
All right, Dr. Vaccarino, thanks you for the promotion. So, what do you think is like maybe your best seller? What do you think you move more here than any other product?
Probably bowls, either a smaller single portion salad bowls or bigger salad bowls. But the epoxy and wood bowls have been selling really well, too. And that's something that's new since last year.
Okay, well, what makes those bowls different?
They just look really cool. they look like wood with stained glass in them, but really it's dyed epoxy.
These ones
resin.
Up here, for example.
Yes, those painted ones?
Yeah.
They're different painting techniques. I don't sell a lot of those, but people find them really attractive. They do draw people into the booth, which helps.
Mm-hmm. So is this what you do full-time now?
I also do photography.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Jack of all trades.
Well, yeah, more or less. Yeah, I'm retired, so I have time to play around.
So I know who you are.
You do know who I am. That's
you need
fabulous.
No introduction.
I rarely need an introduction.
So, what's the name of your business here?
Well, my friend and I, we were in a McDonald's late at night, and we came up, we were like brainstorming what's a good name for a hat company, and in a French fry stupor, we came up with Noggins.
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 And so you sell hats.
I do. I sell hats. So officially a milliner, but because I do a lot of crocheting in the hats, I get to be a professional hooker.
Interesting.
Well, crochet.
Not how I would have put that.
Why not? Crochet does mean hook in French. And really, a crocheter? Like, who wants to be a crocheter? Doesn't even make sense.
It doesn't roll off the tongue, I'll give you that.
It doesn't roll off the tongue as nice as professional hooker does.
Okay. All right. So how do you go about making the hats? What makes your hats? There's a lot of hats here. What makes the Noggin's hats stand out?
Well, if we're talking about the felted hats, they are handmade from top to bottom. So I make my own hood. I felt it myself, I block it, and decorate it. So it's a 6 to 8 hour process. We really are more interested in creating, not manufacturing. So we do every step of the process. Mm-hmm. And we go out of our way to support local. So this year we have wooden buttons made from a local artisan,
oh, wow,
as well as custom-made polymer buttons in the shapes of various animals. And again, it's just—it's not just about, you know, talking the talk of being sustainable and lowering the carbon footprint. It's also about walking it.
Mm-hmm.
So our Re-Noggin's line is made from reclaimed clothing, tablecloths, sweaters, whatever we can find that has a really nice fabric to it.
Mm-hmm.
Our buttons are vintage as opposed to buying them, bringing them in from China. And we reuse all our display items are handmade locally using reclaimed materials as well.
Mm-hmm. So where do you get the materials?
Oh, honey, wherever I can find them. I'm pretty good at finding stuff.
Okay.
I mean, we are a throwaway society.
Mm.
So when you know where to look, you're going to find something. And especially when I'm talking about fabrics, we scour.
Mm.
We scour. And Guelph has a plethora of clothing swaps.
Right.
So at the tail end of the clothing swap, when everybody else is done, we'll go in and have a look and see what's available.
Mm-hmm.
But with my own hats, when I'm looking at fibers, I use a high-end local company out of Toronto, and they're well known for using ethical practices to bring yarns in. Because I want to use like 100% natural, because as soon as it has a bit of acrylic in it, it's never going to decompose.
Mm.
As well, like when you're wearing an acrylic hat, you're literally wearing a plastic bag on your head. Like really, when you think, I mean, it's great if it's been recycled, but it's still just a plastic bag on your head.
I know you're not new to Fair November, so
no.
What makes this such an important date on the calendar, other than the fact that you're local? But I mean, what makes Fair November maybe more special than other craft fairs and things?
It is one of the few craft fairs that I'm aware of in Ontario, maybe even nationally, in which it's a non-profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, I'm sure the university does make some money off of it, but they go out of their way to hire university students and pay them an equitable wage in order to be here. So the university students are here when you come in. They're here. They're always asking for, you know, how do we help? What do we do? So they're here from the time you load in to load out. They sit your booth. As well, they have, it's the only one I know of that offers you a wonderful dinner,
mm-hmm,
where you can go up. So there's opportunity to actually socialize and fellowship with your fellow artisans.
Oh.
I mean, that does not happen at any other show. The best you get is a handmade cookie, which is great. I mean, I like a cookie. I won't lie. But it really feels like they do care about the artisan, and they try to provide that overall service.
So there's no rivalry between hat people here?
There's no point. I mean,
trying to stir the pot here.
To be perfectly honest, nobody makes what we make.
Yeah.
Right? And sure, we have clientele that comes in from all over Southern Ontario. So people coming in from Orangeville, London, and they know. I mean, we had one woman come by and buy a bag full.
Oh,
because
wow,
they know that there's a difference between manufacturing and creating. We create.
Hmm.
There is not one hat that is the same. We've been doing this for like 8-9 years, and we have not repeated.
Mm.
So if you're interested in manufacturing, if like I can make you that $30 acrylic hat, absolutely. But why would I want to, and why would you want to wear it?
Mm-hmm. How many hats do you think you sold this weekend?
Oh, dear. My guess is about 250.
Wow. And how many? I mean, this is not a small number of hats here.
No. It's not. I mean, you want to have enough hats so you're still supplying a good amount of choice at the end of the show. And we do have one of a kind right after this. Like, literally,
yes,
we don't even unpack the van, honey. It's like, so we have to go right from here over to there, like many of the other artisans in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's another reason why Fair November is a good show. It's one of the few shows of this caliber that is free.
Oh.
And many artisans reduce the price a little bit because of that.
Very cool, very cool. I like that we talked a little bit about the business side of this, that it's you know, there's a lot going on that you don't see.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
It's important. And you know, and when you're supporting local, you are helping somebody pay for a kid's education, putting groceries. You're making an artisan give a little happy step. you know that product that you are purchasing has been made with love and creativity and purpose. Mm. It's not being made in a factory by force. It's being made, not being ethical. I mean, we've all seen the documentaries. Mm-hmm. There are some really terrifying documentaries of not good business practices. Mm. So I feel like supporting artisans, you can use that product with a clear conscience.
Good message to leave it on.
And once again, those were some of the vendors from Fair November. They can be found at the various internet locations they cited. And if you missed this year's Fair November, you can certainly find it again on the second weekend of November in 2020. If you are an artisan and if you would like to take part in next year's fair, you can reserve your spot now by going to the Fair November website at fairnovember.ca. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host on Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you do subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. You can reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.